continue with this reflection on Nietzsche this morning. And then, of course, we have a wonderful afternoon of dukkha. But the Buddha put it, whatever is born is impermanent and is bound to die. Whatever is stored is impermanent and bound to run out. Whatever is joined is impermanent and is bound to come apart. Whatever is built is impermanent and is bound to collapse. Whatever goes up is impermanent and is bound to fall down. Sounds a bit grim, doesn't it? But it actually really depends on how we hear that. It also can be remarkably liberating. It seems to me that following the banking crisis and the economic collapse that, you know, has affected so many people's lives so deeply, and the loss of security, status, role, livelihood, there has in some countries been an epidemic of depression and actually a grievous rise in the rates of suicide. While in other countries, people's psychological and physical health has actually improved. And here I'm talking about the Western developed world. And it's been very interesting to look at the difference between those different countries, because they are all part of the Western developed world. As some countries following the economic collapse has followed with, you know, tremendous austerity measures, cutting social and health programs and eroding the safety net, while other countries have actually taken the other path of investing in social and health programs. And in each of these countries, for sure, people were probably the same in being very unprepared for such drastic changes and losses in their life. But what has become evident through research is austerity measures seem to have compounded distress. I've not only lost everything that I relied upon to be a particular kind of person with a particular kind of life, but austerity added punishment. It made that loss a failure, made people see themselves as becoming nobody and somehow unworthy, has been the message delivered through many of the austerity programs. Whereas countries that have invested in health care and support seem to be delivering a different message. Yes, you've lost a lot, but you are still worthy. You're still worthy of care, and you're still precious as a human being, that you are something more than your role and your status and your possessions. And I think these are really describe the two different lens through which we view much of the implications of impermanence, which is that we lose things. We lose things. We are separated from things that we cherish. That we do not only love, but actually we cling so much to secure our world, and as many of us have known, it can disappear in a moment. And certainly in some of the work I've done around depressive relapse, it becomes evident that one of the triggers for depression is unexpected loss. Now, for a person who has profound insight into impermanence and lives in its light, embracing all of the implications of impermanence, there are no unexpected losses. They are unwelcome, they are sad, but there are no unexpected losses, because I think this is part of the implication of living in the light of impermanence, is knowing that all can crumble in a moment. So I mentioned on Friday night when I gave the talk that the Dalai Lama in teaching on impermanence really encouraged people to reflect on all that has disappeared and all that can disappear. Our childhoods, the events and experiences that have so obsessed us at different times in our life, the millions of thoughts, emotions, forgotten. Think of what's disappearing right now. your last breath, sensation, a mental state, an emotion. It's the nature of all things. We know it, to begin and end, to arise and to fade, to be born and to die. And we see it all around us, don't we, in the seasons, in the events, in the experiences, that good fortune and sorrow, that joy and sadness touch us all. It's a personal story and it's a universal story. The average age in Western culture for a person to contract their first chronic illness, the one that cannot be fixed, is 61 in most of Europe, 57 in America. It's an interesting statistic, that one. Some of you here may be in that situation. The one that doesn't go away. The one thing that we can all be sure of in this room is we are all going to have the one that doesn't go away. At least not until we go away. Then it goes away with us. And some of you know this, and you know that you actually begin to contemplate endings. You begin to contemplate endings. The endings of the things that you may previously have been able to do and can no longer do. The loss of an eternal future. It comes through so clearly. The loss of an eternal future. Now that loss, of course, is not emotionally neutral. It is sad. At times heartbreaking, that's human. But the pain of loss, of course, is made much harsher when it's compounded by despair, by anxiety, by blame, by fear. Now, what is our response to all of this? I mean, we know we can't fix impermanence. We can't fix it. We can't make it difference. But we do, I think, forget about it at our peril. The only thing that we can transform is our emotional response to impermanence. It is probably so clear to us in our own felt experience that the denial of impermanence, the argument with it, the argument with the unarguable, has only one effect of making us more contracted, more fearful, more defensive. The aligning of our hearts with the reality of change, I think, opens us really to the universal story and to the possibility of a greater compassion. And these are, in a way, our choices. There is compassion for the losses and the changes that are hard to bear, or there is defensiveness and blame and shame and denial. And in a way, those are the choices that we have. Do we transform our emotional responses, or do we stay in the extra layers of distress making? Many of you will be familiar with that poem of Naomi Shihab Nye around kindness. But part of it is that before you know what kindness is, you must lose things. This is where compassion can come to the forefront. When we lose things, when we feel the future dissolve in a moment, what you held in your hand, what you carefully counted and saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. And then you see the size of the cloth. Geshe Potara, a Tibetan teacher of the past, he said, think about death and impermanence for a long time. Once you are certain that you're going to die, you'll no longer find it difficult to put aside harmful actions, nor difficult to do what is wholesome. After that, meditate a long time on love and compassion. And once metta fills your heart, you will no longer find it hard to act for the benefit of others. Then meditate for a long time of emptiness, on emptiness. Once you fully understand emptiness, you will no longer find it hard to dispel all your delusion. And he ended his teaching with a dedication. Impermanence is everywhere, yet I still think things will last. I have reached the gates of old age, yet I still pretend I am young. Bless me and misguided beings like me, that we may truly understand impermanence. This is something to take seriously. You know, this is something to move from the realm of cliche, that everything changes, into the realm of a felt and a lived reality. Because it is truly an insight that can transform our lives and transform our relationship to all things. And it's a practice. And I think this is so important to sense, that insight is something that is practiced. It is not something you get, you know, and then it goes into some sort of folder in your filing cabinet, you know. It is actually a practice if it's going to have any meaning. I mean, certainly for many of you who've done, you know, more sustained periods of practice, you will perhaps know that in very deep meditative states, there are unarguable experiences of impermanence, where phenomena arise and pass so quickly, where there can be a dissolving of body solidity, where mental events appear and fade, and that nothing is actually graspable. But we don't need to wait for these deeper meditative states. I think we actually have everything we need in this moment to meditate deeply on impermanence. We only need to look at the world around us and to look at the world within us. And what we see is that everything is in a process of changing into something else. And that actually grasping is pretty futile exercise, isn't it? I think I'll just keep this body sensation. I think I'll just keep this sound. I think I'll just keep that thought. Sometimes they last a little longer than we would like, but they disappear. Aversion and craving, again, have something to do with perception, because they are stimulated by perceptions of permanence. When the Buddha speaks about avidya or ignorance or wrong view, that so is the trigger, the springboard for craving and aversion, he really talks about the four distortions of wrong view. And one of them is to see the permanent in the impermanent. The others are to see self where there is non-self, to see the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory, and to see the beautiful in that which is not intrinsically beautiful. But to see permanence where there is no permanence. Our perceptions keep delivering that message. If I go back to what I said, was talking about yesterday around perception, around how the names that designate things into being things seem to deliver this appearance of that's something really solid, you know, that's something lasting, that is something permanent. We want or don't want because we have posited in experiences, events, people and emotions and thoughts the authority and the power to deliver happiness or unhappiness. This is a difficult one. It's what makes us chase the world or avoid life. We have posited that intrinsic power. Imagine I mean, many of you are in relationships or have been in relationships. And imagine if someone came to you and looked you in the eye and said, make me happy. That's kind of a big ask. I mean, how often we look people in the eye, or we look things at things, or we look at events and we say, make me happy. This is a kind of positing of authority into something that does not have that power. So the deep insight into impermanence is actually asking us to withdraw that enchantment, withdraw that invested projection, and instead asking for us to live with a different emotional response to the world of things, people, events, objects. A response of ethics, of appreciation, of care, of compassion and kindness. Now, well, I should have a little pause moment there. Does anybody need a pause moment? Have something to put into a pause moment?
The mood of ignorance. Okay, that's helpful. Because my argument with that is anxiety arises like other afflictive emotions. So, okay. So
the mood of ignorance. The mood of, you know, the part of us of knowing about the world of instability and uncertainty and unpredictability, knowing that and not wanting to know it. And the anxiety that arises in the knowing, but also is more than that. I think it's anxiety is also the mood of helplessness. Not knowing how to meet that world of uncertainty and unpredictability.
It seems though that anxiety, there's a non-cognitive basis to anxiety, certain kinds of anxiety, just, you know, existential anxiety, just, you know, the instability. I mean, you know, frankly, once we realize
well, I think it's born of the realization of instability bears anxiety forth as only as long as it's accompanied with the helplessness. You know, I think that's a necessary ingredient in that perpetuation of anxiety, not feeling that we have the means inwardly, not feeling that we have the refuge inwardly, not feeling that we have the means inwardly to actually meet that uncertainty with equanimity, with balance. So I think anxiety, yes, change triggers anxiety, only I think as long as it's living alongside that kind of feeling of helplessness and being bereft of refuge. It would be my sense of that. So as I started out by saying, the insight into a nature of impermanence is considered to be one of the primary gateways into understanding the Dharma, because it really does provide the opportunity for the heart to release its habitual confusions and anxieties and to abide in what is referred to as right or wise view. I mean, any of you who are familiar with this path will know, like, the path that the fourth noble truth that leads to the third noble truth is actually the cultivation of the Eightfold Path that begins with wise view. And, you know, a lot of our practice is about correcting our view. And it's about shifting our view. And often people feel, you know, they look at the Eightfold Path, they see it begins with wise view, and often feel like, well, I may as well give up now. You know, because if wise speech is dependent on wise view, you know, wise action is dependent on wise view, and I don't have wise view, that means that the other seven factors are all going to be unwise. But it's not linear like that. The Eightfold Path is not linear. The truth is that the cultivation of wise speech, of wise intention, of wise thought, of wise concentration are ongoing ways of correcting our view. Ongoing ways of coming back to wise view. So wise view is not like the kind of, you know, the beginning point and everything hinges on it. In fact, everything else is constantly coming back to wise view. But wise view is being free of those four distortions that I mentioned, but it's actually to know things as they actually are, compounded, changing, and empty of independent self-existence. And it's said to be that understanding that leads quite naturally to resolve, to steadfastness of purpose and direction, and to set our hearts upon awakening. You know, the enchantment with samsara really only continues as long as we reckon that we're here forever. Now, much in this tradition actually speaks of that turning point from enchantment to disenchantment. And enchantment, as it's spoken about, is really the pursuit of our illusion. The pursuit of our illusion, the drive to find security within the insecure. The drive to find certainty within the uncertain, to the drive to find self and secure self where there is not self, the drive to find continuity in what is essentially a world of interfacing changes and conditions. And enchantment is acted out in craving and aversion and clinging. This is where enchantment goes. And the clinging is really only, as I've mentioned, the intensification of the craving and aversion. And they're all in the service of seeking and securing this one thing that is exempt from impermanence, me. All trying to secure that one thing that's exempt from change, me. So disenchantment is not at all a negative concept. It's simply a surrendering of illusion. It's simply a way of putting down the argument with the unarguables and giving up the causes of distress. And disenchantment is truly, it's a way of reclaiming inner freedom. It's not a rejection of the world. It's not a pushing away of the world. But it's a reclaiming of inner freedom. And I think this really does come into being when we no longer place ourselves in that position of being a hostage to the world of conditions, because that's a position of enchantment. Make me happy, you make me unhappy. Now, impermanence is not a complicated teaching. It's not a complicated theory. Everything we touch, see, experience, feel reveals its truthfulness. Yet the insight into it, the genuine insight into it, has profound implications for how we live our lives, the kind of relationships we form with people. Are they deeply rooted in that understanding, or are they rooted in the desire to secure myself and my world? Seeking permanence, on one level it sounds like a good idea, but actually what it does is impose finiteness upon all things and all people and upon ourselves. We say, I am this. You are. Tommy is. And maybe, just maybe, that living in the light of impermanence, we allow ourselves to be surprised. This is often, I think, part of the fabric of freedom. To allow ourselves to be surprised. As I mentioned, yes, the Buddha put it, to have no view of self is to have no view at all. And what views do is impose finiteness upon all things. To have no view does not mean that we have no ethics or responsiveness, but we're no longer endeavoring to fix things in place. We're no longer endeavoring to make things static. And I think there is a deep freedom in being firmly established in process rather than in view. Sadness is happening. Joy is happening. Thoughts appear. People come into our lives and they change. And there's not really beginnings and endings. There's nothing in the life that has beginnings and endings. There's the simple reality that the fading of one thing is part of the arising of something else. The dying of a flower is what strengthens the bulb. The loss of one thing is part of reforming of another. And I think aligning our hearts and minds with this unarguable nature of change is a genuine glimpse of the kind of freedom available to us. Which brings us back to that question earlier of renunciation. You know, really examining that idea that somehow in order to align myself with this changing nature of the world, I have to learn to let go of things. But it's not so. It's not so. We can cultivate the conditions of unbinding. Now, renunciation does have a nature. I think renunciation really does have a character, because it is the ground of all ethical action. It's the ground of all ethical action. It is also the ground of all compassionate action.